Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Hi, I'm KT Nguyen. I'm a psychological thriller author, and my debut novel, You Know What You Did, just came out in April from Dutton Books. And it's a story of a first-generation Vietnamese artist and how her life begins to slowly unravel following the death of her mother.
Welcome to The Vietnamese. I'm your host, Kenneth Nguyen. Being part of a culture of nearly 100 million Vietnamese people in the world today comes with a lot of pain, proud history, and privilege. Join me as I highlight and explore the Vietnamese experience from all over.
Thank you for coming on the podcast. This is long overdue. We made contact earlier in the year. So thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me on. I love your show.
Thank you. So how did your family get to the United States?
Well, my family came over very shortly after the fall of Saigon. My mother was an interpreter and my father was a fighter jet pilot. He led his squadron or whatever. But my mother actually went to college in California before the war. My father trained in Houston with the U.S. military. So they came over pretty early, 1975. And I was in my mother's belly at the time. She was pregnant with me.
So you were born in the United States? Yep, same here. I was in my mother's belly
on route
75. That is, you were born in 75?
Yeah. You look so young.
You too.
When did your family come over?
They came over, they left in April 1975 as well, and then they arrived in the United States probably by October of 1975, and then my mom had me in November 1975.
I was born in November 1975. But we came in through the north, the 23rd. We were in Northern California.
Oh my God, we're Southern. 5 days apart.
Wow, that's crazy. I thought you looked so young. I was like watching some of the videos. I was like, oh, he's much younger than me. I'm not going to know the lingo. That's crazy.
Well, it is crazy. You're born 5 days ahead of me, right before, 5 days before me.
Yeah. So we were in a refugee camp in Northern California, and we ended up moving. I have four siblings who are much older than me. I was the youngest, and we ended up moving to Ohio. Of all places, there were, at the time in the 80s, there were still auto plants, steel factories.
Yeah.
And I think through a Vietnamese connection, my dad ended up getting a job there. So we moved to the middle of nowhere in Ohio.
Yes, my parents did a few months in Ohio as well, coming through from the East Coast. Yeah, coming from the East Coast to the United to California. They spent a few months in Ohio. They had friends in Ohio.
Yeah, I was really surprised because growing up there were no Vietnamese. Very few where we lived.
It's the most random thing, right?
Yeah. And I swear, I don't know if this is possible, but I swear I remember this. Like, it's not a fake memory of going across the country. They put everything into a orange VW van, like a used VW van. All five kids, my mom and dad, they drove across country from California.
So where did you end up growing up?
Ohio. Oh, outside of Cleveland, like an hour outside.
So you spent most of your youth in Ohio?
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was really different because I knew my brothers and sisters, but the closest one in age is 6 years older. And so they graduated and they're a year apart. So every year someone would leave to go to college, or my brother went to the military. Every year someone would leave. And then, so it was just me. And then my parents divorced. So then I was home and it was just me. And I didn't actually interact with a lot of Vietnamese people outside of my family until college. So it was really, I think a lot of people who end up relocating or being located to different places in the Midwest have a similar experience.
Yeah, that's it's true, and it changes the fabric of who you become. I mean, if you're not growing up around a lot of Vietnamese people, it's very different. People our age that grew up in Orange County with a big concentration of Vietnamese people, I mean, obviously they're very different people than people who grew up in Ohio or Texas away from the Vietnamese community. And what makes this all interesting for me, these kind of interviews interesting, is to see the variance of how the thinking of somebody who grew up in Ohio, same generation as me. And I'm here to explore that. That's what I want to know about who you are, and through your writing and through the work that you've done, how the Vietnamese experience of your parents has trickled down to the way you think, and how it's affected your life.
Well, I think growing up in Ohio, for example, without it actually, there weren't other Asian people. My school, maybe my graduating class, it's like a semi-rural school, had maybe 50 people, 55 people. And in the whole school, like the high school, I was one of maybe two non-white students. So it's very, a very different experience. And I think that it has its benefits because when you never fit in and you're always on the outside, in a way, there's less.
Yeah, there's definitely less
Yeah.
pressure. Yeah, and you become something different than if you're growing up in a more homogenous sort of community like Orange County.
Exactly.
And I don't think any way is better or worse, but I think that, just the act of sort of going through all of this growth outside of the community is worth talking about.
I'm so sorry, but I'm trying to find you. The whole thing went away. I don't know
Okay.
if you can edit this. I'm trying to
Yeah,
find
we can edit it. Yeah,
is
we
it
can edit it.
on, it's on Chrome? Okay, yeah, here.
Can
The
you
whole
see me
picture
now?
went away. I can see you. Yeah.
Okay.
I was trying to silence my notifications and I clicked something and sorry.
No problem.
Okay.
Okay. So yeah, I was just talking about the aspect of growing up outside of the community. It's interesting to me that whenever there is Vietnamese people that are growing up outside of it, they become different. It becomes different from growing up in Vietnam. There's 100 million people in Vietnam. Then there is another few million people living outside of Vietnam. But it is there's gradients, there's variances of how Vietnamese people turn out because of growing up in Ohio, being one of two people who are not the, white person in your graduating high school class.
Yeah, it's definitely different. I mean, obviously, there are the obvious negative effects of being isolated, but then there are also positive aspects because you do feel like you never fit in, so you might as well do your own thing. You might as well do whatever you want. And I think there's part of an automatic rebellious, well, I had it, a rebellious response to prejudice or people thinking less of you. There's an automatic feeling of I'm actually better. I can do better, like trying to really be your best self. I was the only one from my school, probably the first one to go to an Ivy League school. And it wasn't pressure from my family or anything. It's
Yeah.
just like, if you have nothing else to do because you're isolated, you read a lot. And I think that's why I became an author. Like my family, we were really. One of my happiest memories is my parents eventually divorced and there was a lot of difficulty, but one of my happiest memories was when I was quite young and we went to the public library because you go there and you can borrow an endless amount of books. It doesn't cost anything. Everyone can get a library card. And so I would just like, I read voraciously. I just read and read and read. And so I think that's one way that being isolated affected me in a positive way.
Yeah.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business and sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/redcircle.
You know, do you ever think about living entirely in the Vietnamese community to see what that experience is going to be like or would be like?
Well, for, let's see, 9 years, 10 years, we lived in the Bay Area, my husband and I. Yeah, we were working out there. I worked in San Francisco and my brother lived in San Jose. So we'd go down there to eat. We'd go around. And it's just a very different experience, obviously, than the way I grew up. It's just crazy. Like the entire, you know, whole different culture, TV channels, movies, everything. It's just a whole different experience.
You know, what I begin to start to explore this, what I'm calling an affliction. It's an affliction of where we as Vietnamese people start to really begin to take on these attributes where we think that there's a standard of whiteness and we don't even detect it. But when we step back and we look at certain patterns of how we're thinking, we can see it. And I'm beginning to explore that more and more in the podcast, which is, there are certain standards of beauty, certain standards of whiteness that when you're living away from the Vietnamese or even within the Vietnamese community, you start to think of your identity, your physical way you look at yourself, the way you look at who you're attracted to. All of these things are things that we're afflicted with that people in Vietnam don't have to live with. And I'm wondering, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no. I've actually, when I was in my 20s, I lived in Asia at various points, not Vietnam, but I lived for a year in mainland China, in Beijing and Shanghai, traveled to Hong Kong. I also lived in Taiwan and Taipei for a year, various studies. And so I think that comparison of, if we're speaking specifically about Asian beauty and then coming to the U.S. is, it's an interesting dichotomy, because I also worked in the beauty industry, because you mentioned that specifically. I was an editor at Glamour magazine, and then I worked for Benefit Cosmetics, which is part of Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy. And that's why I was in San Francisco. So I'm very interested in the idea of different standards of beauty, perceptions of beauty across cultures.
Let's talk about that. Somebody who's on that editorial level at these magazines, were you part of sort of like this, did you put the viewers or the audience or the corporation or any of these levels in check and say, you know what, I'm going to sort of step in and kind of play with the idea of regulated beauty or what we think of as beautiful in America or in the
West?
I
don't think I dealt with, when I worked in those two industries, I worked with the words. So, you know, the art direction side, that's kind of totally different. So you do it, you can. I think my presence there and my contributions in general in editorial meetings helped in that regard, but I wasn't, you know, it's a multinational company. I'm not in a position to do to do that, but I was very vocal. And it's interesting, there I've encountered people who on the business side, you know, that there are certain standards of beauty in China, for example, and all of these Western beauty companies want to go in and like be very profitable there. But then they'll completely disregard the standards of beauty there and select models or select styles that are just for the US. And so why do you think you know better? Like, why do you think you're just going to go and do what you're going to do? Like, that it doesn't make sense.
But why do you think that they know better?
I think, like, when I would speak up, for example, like, this isn't considered an attractive feature there. So they would think, well, that's wrong. Why don't we broaden the, you know, view? Like, what's wrong with that? We should be, like, groundbreaking there. And that's not the culture if you really want to enter into the market and sell beauty products. You're not going to sell them by having someone who people would objectively find, like, not that attractive.
Why did you get out of the business?
I was just in it as a job. And especially on the corporate side, the last 15 years, I was in the corporate side in marketing, and I only did it as a job. And once I'd saved enough money, and I was like, during the pandemic, I'm going to do something creative. I'm going to do something that I actually want to spend my time doing. And that's when I wrote my book.
And how long did you have that sort of that burning desire?
0 minutes. I just had a burning desire to write. I just wanted to do something creative. I also like to paint. I like to sculpt. I like to do all kinds of things. I sew. So writing is something that I think when you grow up reading a lot, you're a humanities major, you work in a magazine. It's just something that you're always doing anyway, composing stories in your head. So when I decided I wanted to do something as a profession that was more creative, I ended up just sitting down and deciding to write a novel.
So you never had a dream of writing a novel or a book?
No, and I'd never written before. Like, they're all the people with their MFAs or they've like written. Fortunately, no, I literally just started writing. I was still working at the time. I was consulting. I was writing like 500 words a day.
That's a lot. Yeah.
Yeah. Pre-COVID, I was still working in San Francisco. So I flew out every Monday and I'd come back on Thursday night on the red eye. And so it's just finding time to write little.
When you know, somebody who's in the business of you know, the magazines and editorial staff, and when you set out to go, like, I'm going to write a novel, you probably have your ducks in a row, how it's going to get published, how it's going to get out there, right? Or do you just go out and you just put it together, you just write, and then you figure it out later?
It's interesting. Because I was in magazines and in these kind of creative fields, you end up meeting people. So I have friends who have written books and gotten them published or screenplays or, you know.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of why I ended up writing a book, because I have a friend who's published a lot of books, another one who her screenplay just won an award. And I think I was kind of jealous. I was like, I want to do that too. A different friend had a book deal announced. I was like, I want to do that too. So I did.
That is such a strange journey. You have no dream. You had no dreams to write a book. Everybody, you know, most people I talk to in the arts are like, I was dreaming about it. I've dreamed of becoming a rap when I was a kid. I've always wanted to do these things. And here
what
you
I
are.
Always wanted, like, I wanted to be, as a kid, I wanted to be a solid gold dancer. I can't dance. My mom wouldn't let me do like a lot of athletic stuff. And she was like, girl, shouldn't do that. So no, I I'm not very coordinated. But I liked their clothes and I liked their dances. That's what I wanted to do. And my mom never pressured me to, like, you know, a lot of people, you want to be a doctor or a lawyer, your parents want you to do that. My mom was always like, oh, you could write and illustrate children's books, or you could like paint greeting cards. Like, she was always kind of like already thinking I was more suited to something creative.
Yep. Now, you probably had a lot of ideas for a book. Why this particular genre?
The genre is because I that's what I was reading at the time during COVID. I've always been a huge mystery buff. And so read tons and tons of, like, all my life I've read mysteries. But during COVID, I don't know, something clicked. And, you know, sometimes people wanted light escapist content during COVID. I actually went the opposite way and I started reading these really dark psychological thrillers because it's just a way of escaping. Like, and so when I wrote my own book, I had just been reading so many of them. I think it came kind of naturally, psychological horror. I was reading Shirley Jackson. I read Stephen King's book on writing. That's the one craft book I was able to read because I have no attention span for those books. So, but his is really good. And he said a lot of his stories just come from imagining and asking himself, what if this situation happened? And I was walking and I thought, what is this perfect situation of psychological horror? I thought, what if my intrusive thoughts, I have OCD, what if those manifest themselves in real life? Like, that would be the scariest story for me. And that's how that story came about. It's an exploration of mental health. And the main character is first generation Vietnamese American. It just makes sense to me because I felt like I could give a lot of complexity to that character.
Did you have any other stories, or was that sort of like, did you sit down and go, okay, here's five ideas and I'll just pick the one that connects with me the most? Or was this something that it was burning inside?
No, I just literally sat down and started writing. And the story went where it went based on the character. I mean, the basic concept was if intrusive thoughts, these terrible, disturbing thoughts manifested themselves in real life. So it just went from there.
It's hard for me to empathize with you because I feel like I'm like most artists, we have a, and it's hard to get a lot of ideas to the finish line, you know, because you have just so, we have so much ideas constantly. It's almost like adult ADHD, you know, ADHD, because we're plagued with too many ideas. And it's, for me, it's hard for me to kind of come to the finish line many times with, the last 25 years of my life, it's been very difficult to finish projects because I, you know, I'm starting to paint this and then I just want to go paint something else. And there's just so much going on.
Huh? I definitely hear you, because with book two, I wrote 40% of a book and then I had to stop to do promotion for You Know What You Did. And it ended up derailing me so much that when I went back to it, I just felt like I wasn't at the same place in my life to finish writing this book. I read it. It's really interesting. I like it. But then I ended up, so now I'm starting a different project. But I definitely see what you mean, because book one, I think because I was just learning the ropes, I was just going through and forcing myself to do write bit by bit by bit. And it got done. This one, I almost have, I don't know if I have too much leeway or too much knowledge now, because I almost feel like, oh, I should do this. I should do that. I should do that. So what you're saying really does resonate, because I've started a couple ideas and then left them. Mm-hmm. And now I'm like, oh, but the reality is I know I just need to sit down and do it, because by doing it, I'll be engaged in the writing.
Yeah.
And anytime I overthink it or set it aside for a bit, then I will lose interest. I just have to keep with it.
And I think that's a lot of people in creative industries have to go through that. You know, it's hard to pick one project and take it all the way. That's why I'm blown away by your story about, you know, during COVID, you were just able to sit down and just knock this book out. You know, that's very rare to have that happen.
Well, I did it bit by bit by bit. So I wrote it, like I said, 500 words. So it was over maybe 10 months.
Yeah. I mean, it's still very to do that. I do want to talk about the OCD thing. How do you, as somebody who is experiencing this in your own body, know?
I didn't know. Oftentimes the onset is around puberty when people start experiencing it. And I definitely had it then. And I didn't know growing up. At the time, I lived just with my mom and she has it as well. But, you know, Vietnamese families, you don't discuss mental health. Like, people of her generation would never acknowledge it. Yeah. So she doesn't believe she has it. She doesn't recognize she has an issue. But I didn't know I had it until my late 20s. well, mid-20s, late-20s, and I didn't do any because it's not the version I have is contamination-based OCD, and it's nothing like what you see on TV with washing your hands and like organizing your closet. It's nothing like that. And it manifested itself in a really debilitating way. And so I didn't know I had it. And when I finally, my daughter was born when I was in my early 30s, I went to see an expert in the Bay Area, and he referred me to a different expert. And luckily, they prescribed a course of treatment that was changed my life. And I highly encourage people to see experts, because in my early 20s in college and later, a couple of times I went to see psychologists, and they just diagnosed me with depression or whatever. And it wasn't, it never really got to the root of the issue. I think you need, if you suspect you have OCD, you really should see a specialist. The IOCDF, International OCD Foundation, has really good resources for all over the country, all over the world.
But how did you get to the point where you go and check yourself in with a doctor or specialist? How did you know that?
It's because I, at that point when my daughter was born, I was like 32 or something, I knew it was OCD. It's just, I had read about it. I'd read a different book about it called Just Checking. It's a nonfiction book. And when I read it at the time, I couldn't believe it. I had never heard of something that was so similar to my experience, where it's contamination-based OCD. You can't have anyone in your house. You can't, like, there's a very solid distinction between inside and outside. What's clean, what's dirty, contaminated. You create these separate worlds, and it kind of ties into identity piece, because home, you're one person. When you grow up in a small semi-rural town, you eat one type of food, you speak one type of language, and then you go to school and you have to be this other person. There's really solid worlds and distinctions. And I think that's similar to the type of contamination OCD I have, where you come home and you have to change clothes and then you know, and I just didn't want, I knew it wasn't sustainable with my daughter being a baby. And, you know, I couldn't drive at the time, so I had to learn how to drive, because you have these concerns that you're going to kill somebody, or did you kill somebody, or did you crash, or did you, you know, can be really debilitating. You can have these really dark thoughts like, oh, I saw that person. Did I actually run them over and not realize? It's really interesting.
Hence the book.
Yeah, much... hence the book. It's quite a dark book. And I like to compare it to Stephen King meets Celeste Ng. Because there's that kind of Asian, there's a family drama and there's psychological horror and this descent into madness. So it's not, it's interesting because it's not quite fitting neatly into any one genre.
Can we talk a little bit about your mother and OCD and your...
Yeah, but I don't think she'd want me to talk about her too much because she's still alive. But
okay,
yeah.
Let's not talk about her too much. But I guess what I want to know is, this OCD, is it something that we pick up from our parents, or is it a genetic trait?
No, definitely. There's a huge genetic biochemical component to my OCD, which is why I respond, had such an amazing response to medication. It's like a biochemical imbalance. I think they say 40-something percent of contamination-based OCD cases are genetic, like inherited. They're learning a lot more about it. It's not, it's very much, in a lot of cases, biochemical and genetic. In a lot of cases, they're learning more about it every day, but it's definitely not, because a learned behavior, because the way that OCD manifests, even though it's the same region of the brain responding, the compulsions can manifest themselves in completely different ways. So someone who checks to see if the stove's turned off, you know, constantly has OCD. But you can also have the kind of OCD where you're going to harm someone, or you worry that something is dirty. There are just so many different kinds. And it's interesting because there have been studies with Vietnam War veterans and refugee families relating to PTSD and cases of OCD. Their incidence of OCD are much higher. Hoarding, a lot of cases. I mean, you see veterans on the street, both sides of the war. It's just an effect of having to leave everything behind, losing control. When you speak of generational trauma, there's actually, you know, damage done. It's crazy to think
damage.
That you, yeah, come here and be totally unscathed because you have a chance to get a job. Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are great, there are benefits, but there's real damage done.
Yeah. I know a few hoarders, Vietnamese hoarders. Yeah.
Definitely.
And, you know, if they came over when they were teenagers, they were affected by the loss.
Yeah.
And they go untreated and they just begin to keep things. And, you know, that's their sort of their security blanket. My uncle, my mom, and my brother have minor forms of OCD. All three of them have to touch something like three or four times before they're like, it's weird. Like they'll touch a knob on a stove or whatever, or they have to touch it like three times. And they talk about it all the time. It's like weird. And
you might not know the extent of it. So if you should question that and push back a little bit, because like I had it when I was at a Glamour magazine, I was an editor. Nobody knew. Nobody would know because I had the separate world. The things I did, the compulsions were when I was at home, you know, not outside. You wouldn't know. You don't necessarily know what people are struggling with, as you know. I think that it's just one of the remnants of being a refugee and growing up in that kind of family. It's very difficult and it's not something that's necessarily acknowledged or talked about a lot.
That's very rarely talked about. Very rarely. And how can war not damage human beings? How can it not?
I don't know how you can expect to be totally unscathed. But if you spoke to, for example, my mother, she would think, oh, no, not, it didn't affect me.
you guys are a weak generation. You guys can't handle, you know, that's the response to all this.
It is. And when I grew up, I've heard this in other Vietnamese authors have mentioned this. For years and years, I hated going to school, but I also couldn't see because my parents thought that, or especially my mother, that wearing glasses would make my eyes weak, like it was a sign of weakness. I literally would sit there and I couldn't see the blackboard. And there was this assignment, I can't remember what it's called, it was a daily assignment where they put a sentence on the board, you had to copy, and I couldn't see it. And it was just like so much, such a strange pressure, but I've actually heard that with this one other author I spoke with, that she wrote a memoir and she had the exact same experience.
She had the same problem, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very, her father said, no, it's like, yo, deal with, just, that is incredible when you think about how, like, really, but at the same time, I think, when going back to OCD, it could be also a gift too, no? Some of the benefits of having OCD? No, not at all. Like, I think
some people try to see it that way. I have a relative who I won't name, but she has OCD and it takes the form of perfectionism. And she's an artist. So she thinks, oh, I'm just, you know, being a perfectionist. I'm just getting every detail right. But the reality is, if you can't mail a package because you're concerned, it's how much it interferes with your life. You're concerned you're not going to have.
How debilitating it is.
You're not going to write the address correctly. It's not perfect enough. Or if it takes you hours to like do something because you're just trying to like perfect it, it's very easy to convince yourself that it's a good thing or it's not as bad as it seems. I mean, there are people with mild cases, or that doesn't affect them. It's not debilitating. But there are so many cases where it is debilitating and it is affecting you and you try to convince yourself it's not. And that's one of the things I wanted to do with the book was have a really raw, visceral portrayal. And I think people have responded to that because it's psychological horror, that every kind of semi-horror scene in the book is based on something that actually, like when I was at the height of my OCD, went through my head.
And those are sort of the best stories is when there's a universality in the ability to relate to something like this, even though it's not exactly what somebody might be debilitated or something exactly like OCD, the form that you're going through. But if we, It's just like horror movies, I think Get Out. When you're watching something, you go, wait, I could relate to that. And it's not like jump out loud, like scaring you, boo, boo, boo. But it's like this deep sort of these psychological fears that we actually have as members.
And I think that's why that movie was so effective as social commentary as well, because it was really reached a wide audience. Even like, say you're a white person, you watch it, it helps you understand what it feels like.
That's the genius of Jordan Peele, right? He understands that how social commentary and horror is relating on a visceral, on a guttural level, where we are terrified of the things that have not been named yet. And then this sort of comes out. And
it goes back to your question of why this genre. It's because I really love psychological horror and psychological thrillers, because they point to the everyday evil, the evil next door, the evil in your house, your neighbor. It's the most insidious and damaging type of evil. It's not this monster. Yeah. It's not, you know, like a vampire.
After you put this out into the world, has it made you better in that way, dealing with OCD or whatever you were sort of afflicted with, that darkness?
It's kind of like the book, writing the book thing, because my case, I had very severe OCD, but because of the biochemical aspect, I found the right medication and it just literally, I have it got it totally under control within like 6 months.
Wait, you got it under control in 6 months?
Yeah. Yeah, because people, and so some people feel like, and it's my personal experience, some people feel like, oh, well, in the book, the character should have gone through cognitive behavioral therapy, exposure therapy. She should have struggled. And that's a lot of people's story. But in my experience, and that's not the main idea of the book. It's a genre book. It's a fun thriller. Her experience is much more similar to mine. I just literally, this medication helped correct the imbalance. So I have those thoughts, like it's in the room, but I don't need to respond to them at all. I don't need to listen to them. Like I might think, and then the thoughts are also much less. Like I might go to a restaurant and think, something, because I've discussed face obsessive compulsive disorder, I might say, oh, who sneezed on this fork? Or like, this is disgusting, but I'll still use it. In the past, I wouldn't have been able to even, like, riding the subway in New York was extremely difficult. You know, there are just a lot of the BART in the Bay Area. I once went home from work and there was like a bag of vomit on the ground. If you have an aversion, you have a specific contamination aversion to bodily fluids, which is what I had. It's kind of not ideal. But luckily, that's why I encourage people to go and see an expert, even if you think you can manage it on your own. I think it's very helpful.
Can you imagine all of the homeless people out in the world today being afflicted by all of these inner demons that are coming from biochemical afflictions and being untreated? And you look at society and how many homeless people are existing in these big cities, and they're just not being treated. And it's it is pretty simple if we think about, like, just popping a pill and getting treatment and getting that all under control over, right?
It is. I mean, that would be amazing, but having older relatives in my own family, it's not that easy, because there is the stigma of mental health treatment. There are all these other issues to overcome before you can actually take that pill, unfortunately. And you think of people like my mother in her 80s, she's not going to change. Like, they're not going to be able to convince her to start taking a pill.
But when you look at your mother, do you have this sort of idea that it could help her if she got diagnosed? Do you think it's a biochemical issue for her?
Yeah, I think a lot of it would definitely help a great deal. The same with other relatives in my family. But because OCD isn't something that actually makes you a danger to other people or yourself necessarily, It's not something that could be forced upon someone. It has to be your choice. And I think hopefully talking about mental health issues will make it reduce the stigma a bit. People will feel more comfortable getting help, but they have to do it, make the decision.
Can you imagine a lot of us are going through crazy things that could be solved by diagnosis, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
If you're thinking definitely.
About it, a lot of things that are holding somebody back could be an issue of just going to therapy, getting it really, really diagnosed, and then addressing it on a biochemical level and it being resolved, you know, like this perfectionist person that you're talking about, or, you know, the contamination issue that you're talking about. It could really hamper your progress in life if it goes unchecked for 40, 50 years of your life. And pretty soon you wake up one morning and you're like, my career was stunted because I couldn't look past this issue.
Well, three things. One is you should start a startup with that sales deck, that pitch. That's a great idea. Two, my case, and my doctor commented on it as well, was unusually successful. Most people do need to go through exposure therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy. I had an excellent response to the medication, so that is definitely not the usual response. It's definitely on the positive side.
Probably have you been to Vietnam?
I haven't.
You have
I
not?
I haven't. No, my siblings, my brother's gone. I've never been.
Do they feel like they're more Vietnamese?
I don't think so, because my siblings are 6 to 10 years older than me, and they speak Vietnamese and understand more Vietnamese than they do.
How?
I think because I grew up with my mom, because they all left and I was home and isolated. Definitely understand more and speak more than my older siblings, which is strange because I have a sibling who lives in San Jose and is surrounded by Vietnamese people. So I don't know.
Yeah, all of this is sort of like for me, it's sort of, pardon the term, it's a mind fuck for me sometimes. because I mean, we're all like coming from this homeland, right? Vietnam. And some of us are in our 50s now, and we have no connection to any of the traditional ways or thinking of our parents or people that are existing in Vietnam that look like us, that have our same genetics, but we're very, very, very different. And it's like, for me, I can't stand to live like that. I can't be disconnected from that body of people. It's just inside of me where I can't exist and live not knowing that there is like 100 million of the people that look like me is out there existing a certain way, and I don't know anything about it. I just have this like extreme FOMO about the Vietnamese way of living. And you know, the Vietnamese way of living is, there's so much color, right? There's just so much variation in Vietnam, but I want to know all of it. And I want to know all of it from the people who grew up in Ohio or the people who grew up in San Jose and Orange County. I want to just be a part of everything.
It's so crazy because we're the same age. I think part of it is also because my mother is older and she lives with me and I take care of her. So I think that's partly, I feel like always that connection there. And I don't think I don't think I'll go to Vietnam until she's left us. Then I will
really?
Go. Yeah, she can't travel anymore. Like, she could not make that flight. So, but my dad, before he passed away a couple years ago, he went back and he visited some of the sites where his brother was murdered, like, you know, killed in the war. And he talked to people, but he towards the end, he was very much, because he was a fighter pilot, but towards the end, he was very much, oh, we're all the same. You know, he didn't hold harbor grudges or have thoughts, you know, he was very much, we're all the same. It's just, it's past, but he didn't really talk about it a lot.
Yeah. My dad said the same thing too. It's
like, yeah.
None of this makes sense. None of this war, you know, stuff makes sense with where we are today.
And it's what's interesting to me is refugees from all different wars going on now, children, it's just the idea of the effect it has on you and generations after. I think that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what happens to the children of war and what they become and what their children become and how it affects. But it's almost crazy in the universal scheme of everything. Why do we do this to each other? It's just so... It's continuing to go on. You know, this is what's bizarre about this all is how can we continue to like live after hundreds and hundreds of years of learning that this does not help mankind and we're still doing it. There's still like multiple wars ravaging the earth right now. We're still going through modern 2024 and we're still doing it.
Doesn't help mankind, but it probably helps a few people. Yeah. Weapons manufacturers, heads of, you know, various governments.
Yeah. And it's like people are cleaning up after this stuff with, you know, trauma and the debris of what happens mentally and emotionally.
Well, you look at that train wreck interview Elon Musk did with Donald Trump on X recently, which I did not tune into, but I read about after, and his mention of the atomic bomb in Japan. Elon Musk, he said, oh, look, you know, people view that as a really awful thing, but it's all fine now. They're a great economy. It's like, really, you're just glossing over all the generations of people affected, the death. If you're really going to view humanity in that cold way, then you're not going to be someone who's concerned about war.
And they're probably all looking at it that way. And I think for somebody who is not really plugged into other people, feelings and how people feel on the ground, you know, both of those guys are disconnected in some strange way.
I think that's why whatever the creative outlet I choose, I like writing or whatever, I think that all of these art forms help people be empathetic, to see different viewpoints, see the world through a different lens. So I think all of them are incredibly valuable. Otherwise, you end up with a lot of Elon Musk and Donald Trumps. So I don't think Vietnamese people need to encourage their kids to go into the arts.
You're saying that they don't need to encourage their kids into the arts?
No, they should. They should.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We don't need more business people and lawyers in the world.
Yeah, we don't. We definitely need more creative people, especially creative Vietnamese all over the world. I think, you know, but there's a... not a clear line, but there is some sort of leaning if you're a creative person to, you know, vote a certain way. You vote Democrat. You're in business, you vote as a Republican. And I think these are very clear lines that are I mean, I have empathy for both sides. I really do. We just have to find a balance for the practical side of business and money. And then clearly the creative understanding of human emotions and why those ways of looking at life is so important.
Well, I think anytime you're taking care of your neighbors, taking care of the community, creating healthy communities, that's going to be good for business too.
Yeah, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
You can't go wrong. Yeah. KT, thank you so much. I really enjoyed this. Can we talk about where to find the book?
Yes, you can find the book wherever books are sold, actually. It's everywhere. But preferably go to your independent bookstore. It's one of the benefits of being published by a big publisher. You can find the book anywhere. There's audiobook as well.
Thank you, KT.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Vietnamese with Kenneth Nguyen. Special thanks to Brittany Tran, to Jane Nguyen, Catherine Nguyen, Tina Pham, Sydney Jamie, and Crystal Trinh. Please find us on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok at The Vietnamese Podcast.
This podcast is brought to you by the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection Arcade Classics. 7 legendary titles, including X-Men vs. Street Fighter and Marvel vs. Capcom 2. Enjoy new features like online multiplayer, training, and gallery modes. Plus, join in on the action with one-button specials, where players of all skill levels can unleash those epic moves with ease. Relive the classic arcade battles. Get your hands on the Marvel vs. Capcom Fighting Collection today. Available now on PlayStation 4, PC, and Nintendo Switch.